This is a production of Cornell University.
In 2014, that I really began to appreciate the role of shared governance here. I found myself for a very brief period of time studying at a university where the idea of students having access to the administration, to the board of trustees, or to the president was just laughable and unfathomable. Cornell was founded on principles that any person can find study in any discipline, and as a land-grant institution, I've had the enormous privilege to benefit from that. I've been an undergraduate here, I was an employee for several years, and now I'm a graduate student, an athletic coach for a varsity team. I'm a teacher. And my experience spans the sciences, humanities, and the social sciences. But it's important to recognize that this any person claim that the university throws around comes with a giant qualification. Not every person has affordable access to a Cornell education, and while here, not every person has access to a truly shared government. A lot of the power here really isn't that distributed. Our challenge today is not to outright dismiss the vision that Ezra Cornell has, but rather to respond to the campus climate issues of 2018 in a way that does not continue to erase the long history of discrimination on this campus. That history is really important, and it matters, especially in how we view today's entrance guarantees. By voting for me, Rebecca Harrison, to represent the student body on the Cornell Board of Trustees, you are voting to elect a candidate with over 8 years of institutional knowledge of this university. But I've pretty much always been pretty disgruntled with campus politics. And I feel that a lot of the current politics on campus distract from the bigger picture of the unique opportunities presented by this university.
Thank you, Rebecca. Manisha?
Yeah. So for those of you who haven't had the opportunity to meet yet, my name is Manisha Minasinghe, and I am a third-year PhD candidate in computational biology. So I am running to be the next student elected trustee because in the last 3 years that I've spent here at Cornell, both as a student and a student advocate, I've come to realize that Cornell can and should do more. If elected to the Board of Trustees, my top three priorities would be, one, bringing diverse student perspectives to the board. More often than not, the same set of students have access to the board, and the students that don't have their voice heard are oftentimes the first ones that are impacted by board decisions. The second priority for me is promoting financial transparency, so that students not only understand Cornell's financial investment and policies, but that they also get an opportunity to contribute to that conversation. And third, building a more inclusive campus. I think it's pretty obvious that this last year's events have shown that we have a lot of work to do. So if elected, I would prioritize expanding financial and logistical support for our campus resources, resource centers, for student organizations, and educational programming on campus that is doing the work to build that more inclusive campus right now.
Okay, thank you, Manisha. Tatiana.
Thank you, guys. You guys really put out some important points, and I want to echo that, but I'm coming here with a totally different perspective. I'm your oddball candidate. I can't say I know many of you, although many faces do seem familiar. I'm the candidate that I would want as a student trustee because not only do I have executive experience at different universities, but I'm committed to making an objective decision as a student trustee. Why is experience important? Experience allows us to voice a student voice in front of the board, of course. However, it is objectivity that allows us to put our alliances of student organizations behind and act on behalf of the complete student organization and the complete student body. What does this mean? That I have 2 years of executive experience as vice president of my undergraduate university and as co-president of my exchange university, Sciences Po in Paris. I've had the opportunity to work within institutions to advocate for student voice. But that being said, I can offer a fresh perspective. I've seen how student voice can be advocated in different institutions. And so I'm offering you a different candidate, hopefully one that can bring not only the student perspective from the graduate as a native, but also as an exchange, as I've been in two other institutions. And then finally, I want to say that I'm committed to having organizations remain autonomous. I echo as my fellow candidates have expressed, student organizations are the ones closest to the students, so therefore they are the best advocates of the student voice. I want the board to have a bigger ears, be willing to accept student recommendations and student voice throughout the year. So I'm honored to be here, and if you have any questions for me, please let me know. I know I'm probably the one that you probably least recognize, so thank you.
So if you have any questions for all or any of the candidates, you can raise your flag or hand. Nate,
I am Nate, and then Jim. Alright, thank you guys for coming. My first question is this, could you describe your opinion on Cornell's current policy for the Fed Net? You know, think about how the Cornell has decided to set that up.
Oh,
sure,
I'll go first. Okay, so I think there are a lot of issues that students have expressed a lot of concern with regarding investments that the Board of Trustees have made that go against our values as a community. The sort of unfortunate reality of how our endowment works is that when we make a negative return on our investment, the people that are impacted first are students who rely on financial aid, because 20% of the returns on our endowment go directly towards financial aid. So I say that not to say that we shouldn't divest, but that we need to strategically divest in such a way that we don't impact financial aid and hurt our most vulnerable students. So I really think this is a responsibility of the investment committee, of the board of trustees, to figure out how we do that in such a way so that we can divest from things that go against that the student body has expressed concerns with, without hurting our most vulnerable student population.
I completely, I echo. I think that you need to be strategic with the ways that we divest from it. In any way, shape, or form, financial issues need to come down to having not only those interested in their pocket, but also the people that are being impacted by these financial decisions. At the end of the day, we have to, I'm very lucky, I'm a PhD student that's funded, right? But graduate students have to pay to be here. The Board of Trustees is responsible for making sure that the students that they admit are successful getting out. And so whether that means that reevaluating financial decisions on the board's behalf is a priority, then that needs to be a priority.
Thank you. Can I turn around and ask whether you're referring to divestment in general or related to any specific elements?
The divestment, so Cornell outlined basically their policy not on divestment for issues of the process and how they would choose to divest.
But you're speaking specifically to the process.
I'm speaking specifically to that policy of how they construct it.
And I guess I would echo what my colleagues would have to say. I guess I could speak to some specific issues as well. When you echo the word divestment on this campus, one thing that a lot of our students talk about is, or immediately jump to, is on sustainability and carbon neutrality on this campus. And I think that conversation, along with the conversations on the board, has a lot to do with that issue as well. And I think this comes down to a lot of the conversations about looking at the board morally, but also looking at the board as the fiduciary of the university, and trying to balance how, as a student trustee or as a trustee in general, you balance that those two things might often be in conflict.
Thank you.
Hi, Jesse.
Yeah, so I just wanted to invite each of you to say something about what you'll be doing should you not get the business trustee. And I ask that question not because I kind of cute, like, it's not the question you should ask, but what I'm kind of looking for an answer is your visions for how graduate students have a hand in the working of Cornell besides these kinds of small mechanisms that you're looking for right now.
So we'll start with Tatiana.
Sure. Well, I think I echo this because I'm a first year, and I realized how difficult it was to become involved on campus. The graduate community is extremely divided among departments, and I think each of you, if you haven't felt that way, you know constituents who have. And so I've looked for ways to get involved, and I've created ways for people to get involved, not only in my department, but departments that share common research interests and alignment. So I would continue to do that. I think we continue to foster our community. I know that right now I lead with like 7 or 8 other students meetings between the AIM, the TAM department, SOCH department, and econ. And so that's great because we have shared ideas. How much benefit do we get from being able to pry on each other's resources, bounce off ideas, and further our research? I mean, at the end of the day, we all want to leave here with an amazing paper that we can take to the job labor market. And so what does that mean? We can build a better community while we're here that will help us be more successful coming out of here.
Thank you. Jessica?
Should I not receive this position or be elected to this position? I look forward to having another year during my term on the general committee in the graduate school, where as one of the two student representatives from the GPSA, we represent the student voice in making decisions about the codes for this graduate school. I also look forward to spending time. I work with a lot of undergraduates in varsity athletics. I'm an assistant coach for the varsity freshman team, which I'm an alumna of as well. And so it's been great, in addition to my teaching, to be able to interact with students and undergraduates at that level. So yeah, a lot of the same, hopefully more involvement in this organization as well.
Yeah, so folks might be happy or unhappy to hear, but I'm actually not planning on returning to the GPSA Executive Committee. I've had a really great opportunity to serve, and I've learned a lot, but I'd like to allow other people the opportunity to be on the Executive Committee
I do plan on still staying in GPSA, but because I have a very fond place in my heart for chair governance. I'm going to be like Jesse. I'm going to be here for 5 years. but something that I've become really concerned about is actually how we pass on institutional knowledge about how this university works. So something that I've been working on with a colleague of mine is actually a leadership development training program for first and second year graduate students that teaches them about what the administrative offices are on campus, what are the administrators in their office, what are they responsible for, who do you go to if you want to put like plan an event, who's responsible for international student needs, and really making sure that that knowledge is passed on so that you know, people in student organizations or even on our assembly that want to get involved can do that without having to like sift through the mess of our online websites and figure out like who's responsible for what. Yeah, I do not want to recreate the wheel.
Thank you. So next I have Max. Okay, so you said you yield, right? Okay, Arabic.
My question to all three of you, it focused on the election process for the Board of Trustees, the Supervisor of Trustees. We know that there are two trustees, and traditionally, by definition, one of them is supposed to be defined as an individual undergraduate student on campus, and the other is defined as the individual graduate professional student on campus. And yet, we know that in both elections, the entire student body gets to vote for student trustee. And I think this brings a sense of unease just because of the proportions of numbers, where there's a sense that if one year to be a successful graduate student trustee, they needed to get a significant number of votes from undergraduate students on campus also. What are your thoughts on that? And if you had the opportunity, would you change that? How would you change that?
I mean, that's an interesting question. I see it as an opportunity, not necessarily a limitation. I think that for the sake of looking at shared governance at Cornell historically, I think that, you know, graduate students and undergraduates have had a lot of successful collaboration. I think that graduate students oftentimes bring different viewpoints from their undergrad institutions, whereas undergraduates are excited and ready to go and oftentimes have a unique fire in their belly for serving their university. I think that it's an opportunity, and I think that it'd be foolish to think that we can easily separate the two.
Yeah, so I think part of the reason why it's structured that way is because there is only one representative from the undergrad, one from the graduate, but they outnumber us 2-1. And so there's this idea that if you allow them to vote in this election, they'll have more representation on the board. But I actually think that we should fix that by increasing the number of undergraduate student elected trustees to 2, not just because then it's more equally represented, but also because the current one undergrad seat really limits who is able to apply for those positions in the undergraduate student population, which I think is unfair. And I would encourage the 2 undergrad trustees to be elected by the undergraduate population, the graduate and professional student trustees to be elected by the graduate and professional student population. And while I do see Becca's point, I do think that there has been a lot of successful collaboration between graduate students and undergrads, even though we're like elected by different communities. We co-sponsor resolutions, pass through some different things. So I think there's still a lot of room for that collaboration, even if they're elected by distinct bodies.
So that's an excellent question. I really haven't thought about it, but I would pose that my pushback on that and say maybe the problem isn't that we only have 2 student representatives and that one's from the undergrad and one's from the professional graduate student. Maybe the problem is that we really have low voter turnout, and that if we added another candidate in another election or some another name to this bustle-in like bureaucracy elections, we really wouldn't get more people turning out to vote, but the same people turning out to vote. So I would argue or push back that maybe our efforts need to be focused on explaining what is this institution, who are the leaders, what does the Board of Trustees do? Plenty of people have asked me, what are you running for? And getting out the vote, explaining why it's so important. I can't tell you how many student organizations have replied that we'd rather stay neutral, we don't want to vote. And I reply, you know, hey, I don't need an endorsement, I totally don't need to speak at your organization, but you know what I'd love? For you to tell your organization to vote. Inform them that there's 3 candidates. Inform them when is the voting going to happen. Because at the end of the day, elections are decided by who shows up, right? And if it's the same 1,000 students voting, it really wouldn't make a difference to add another position on our Thank you. I think we have time for one more question, Matt.
I really appreciate all three of you taking the time out of your day to come here. I know who your members are here anyway. I've heard a lot of people talking about, oh, graduate students will be on that. And I mean, there are, there's a third constituency here, that's professional students, which has really been kind of, people been dancing around, people are either not committing it or they're butchering it in some way. My question is, what do you see as the largest issues facing the professional student community, and how do you plan to meet their student needs if you're on the board?
Manisha?
Yeah, so regarding professional students, I'm particularly concerned about professional student debt, not just the students who are able to like attend our institution, but also people who want to attend our institution and just do not have the funds to pay the students. So I think that would encourage more robust financial aid packages for professional students, but also I think that there's a role that we as student leaders have to play in advocating on a national level, because there are several national level bills that could really negatively impact professional students, particularly things like the PROSPER Act, like for the public service loan forgiveness. So students who are in professional programs that would like to do public service afterwards, but feel like they can no longer do that because they have student loan debt to pay off. So I think that the role of the trustee, actually, they do meet with University of Federal Relations, and can, they do have the opportunity to participate, like any student that's in Cornell Advocacy Day. I'm down in D.C. for that. And I was down in D.C. for that this year.
Thank you.
So might be surprising, I'm a first-year PhD student in policy analysis, but all of my undergrad, I went with the idea of I wanted to be in law school after undergrad. So many of the issues of applying to grad school come last May when I entered or graduated from my undergrad were, am I going to be able to afford the application process? Nevertheless, getting into and being able to sustain myself in a grad, in a professional school, and I apologize, I'm like tripping over it, in a professional school. As a professional student, where I would have to pay for a tuition versus as a PhD student where I do get a stipend. So I do understand and I completely echo your concern for rising tuition costs and the loan forgiveness program that is no longer going to be available if the federal administration passes this legislation. I think that we can better our university by increasing financial literacy, by lowering the application costs, and also by connecting students with resources outside of the university that are financial providers. I know that many of the survey respondents from the exit surveys of the master's program said that they didn't get any kind of information on where they could get financial resources outside of the university, or didn't get like information or guidance on how to apply for these grants. So I think it's important that we streamline these types of resources. And at the end of the day, a person choosing to come to Cornell is making a big financial investment, especially if they're a professional student, where they have to set the bill.
Okay. And not to sound like a broken record, I'm also going to state that as an undergraduate here in animal science, I was on a pre-vet track for a long time. I know there's a few vet students in the room. The prospect of getting paid to go to grad school, or at least get compensated in some way to go to graduate school, was incredibly enticing and a huge part of my decision not to go to professional school. But I think that that is like the macro issue, but under the debt issue comes a lot of other student issues of Cornell students and graduate students. Mental health issues, affordable housing, all of these things all fit under that access to an education that's affordable or at least livable. And I think that those all, the demographic of being in your mid to late 20s, early 30s, and trying to start a family and being financially sustainable while making the decision to pay for school and ultimately be a significant revenue source for a university like Cornell is a big decision. And I think that those of us who are graduate students are in very different positions than some professional students, but I think that you're right. I think that's a huge, huge part of this conversation.
Okay, thank you very much. So we have like a little bit of time for like a short closing remark. Tatiana, would you like to start?
Sure. Right. Taking out materials from coming up to me. So each and one of you will have the opportunity next week to choose the next student trustee. And as I've already mentioned, elections are decided by those that vote. And I have no question that each of you are vested in voting. You're here because you're student leaders and appreciate the process. So maybe this spiel doesn't pertain to you. But I want to say that I'm the candidate that is pushing you to vote, and I want you to keep me in mind, but I'm also pushing you to think about this role as one that is objective, that looks at the numbers when it comes to the board, that's willing to hear out the issues and the decisions the board has to make, and attack each of the duties with complete objectivity in decision-making. I don't have any kind of experience in the sense that would influence me to vote in any which way. And so I appreciate, of course, your time and inviting us to speak with you, and I hope that we'll have more in the future.
Thank you. So as some of this conversation started to lead today, as well as some things that I've voiced my opinion on during GCSA meetings in the recent past, there are a lot of things with Cornell that I'm frustrated by, but there's also a lot that I'm clearly passionate by, or I would not still be here. But there are places where I've come to understand Cornell's unique institutional history as an opportunity, both its history, its geography, its demography, as both an elite private university, but also the land grant of the state of New York. So it is a very interesting, unique university with lots of progressive opportunities for both students and our local communities. For instance, the more substantive things that we haven't gotten to talk about yet, but I hope to in the debate later, we should be setting an example among our peer institutions for how graduate student labor should be protected. We should be taking the successes of programs like the Cornell Prison Program and mirroring those energies in other regional and community extension activities such as the Cornell Farmworker Program. We should be supporting the arts and humanities, whether we're talking at the scale of our campus cinema, whether we're talking at the scale of our undergraduate arts and humanities curriculum, or even at the scale of the Cornell Tech campus in New York City. I'm interested in grounding my efforts on the board within Cornell's institutional history, holding the university accountable and advocating for more transparency. My academic work is at the intersection of the social sciences, the humanities, and the sciences. As an undergraduate, a former employee, a student athlete, an assistant varsity coach, and a graduate student who's now just deciding to become involved in campus politics, my unique experiences have thus far prepared me to represent the intellectually diverse and resilient community that is our Cornell community.
Great, so I really just want to reiterate that I have spent the last couple years trying to advocate for students, and I've kind of come to this realization that we need a culture change at the highest levels of our administration, not just our administrators, but also on the Board of Trustees. And that's what this position is, an opportunity to change the culture on the Board of Trustees. As many of you know and have seen, I'm not afraid to speak my mind, and I'm not afraid to tell the Board of Trustees how I think, and how I think, how based off of my communications with students, how they think. I really believe that this is an opportunity to create a space for the Board of Trustees to communicate with students and actually start making decisions that are in the best interest of students instead of making a decision, finding out it's not in the best interest of students, and then trying to force a horse to water. So, yeah. That should have been your metaphor, yeah. If anyone has any other questions for me, I'll be around, obviously, so we can talk to you.
Okay, so thank you very much, Manisha, Becca, and Tatiana.
I would also echo the call to vote on, which is like just next week, April 16th, 18th, and we'll be getting more information on that later as we get closer to the date. Okay, and now we have Alex doing an update of officer staffing.
Hi everyone. So there's been discussion in the GPSA Option Staffing Committee that was initiated due to recent discussions about how this assembly handles cases where there's alleged misconduct. So One question is, why do we need to care about this? Why do we need a misconduct protocol? So, as I alluded to, there's been things that have happened where they've clearly shown that what we have in the bylaws is not adequate. There's too much ambiguity in terms of who hears a complaint, how they rectify the complaints, how do they review the complaints. And there were also issues in terms of what happens when someone in this assembly is also in another assembly, and then who gets to remove whom. And then Becca brought a resolution saying, we should address this. And most of us were like, well, yeah, we should address this. So that's what we're doing. So I'm going to run through a couple of the different issues that we've been talking about recently in Ops in terms of how to address cases of misconduct in the assembly. So one of the biggest things is, what constitutes misconduct? What's our assembly's community standard, right? Like, what can we agree on is how people should operate when they're representing people? Who should hear complaints? How do we review them? When do we review them? What can the review do? Lots of things like that. Can we suspend someone while they're being reviewed? Can they appeal what we decide? How do we tell people they're under review or that someone in their committee is under review? These are all things that we've had ideas bouncing around about. So to briefly say what this draft outline is that is in the minutes packet, basically this is addressing things like who hears a complaint and when the hearing or the review is initiated, kind of how it works. When do we tell the complainant, the accused, what's going on, and how you can do an appeal, how long this all should take. What this doesn't cover is what are these standards of conduct, and what happens when there's an issue in another assembly as well, and what to do to replace someone who would remove. Since no one wants to read that 4-page document of legalese-ish text, I made this nice little flowchart. So basically, what we are proposing right now, but nothing is set in stone, is that the council is positioned as the person in the assembly who has experience and would be probably the most objective person to hear a complaint. So we're saying that should be the person designated to hear a complaint of alleged misconduct. And then they would talk to the VP of operations. And from there, they would have a choice of how to go forward. They could either both agree that there's nothing to the complaint, and then they just say, they write down why they dismissed the complaint. But this has to be unanimous. If it's not unanimous, then they can either try to have the council mediate some sort of agreement between the complainant and the accused, or you can go towards an actual review. And we think that the most logical place to have a review would be in the Operations and Staffing Committee, since the vast majority of these things are involving people that were appointed by the Operations and Staffing Committee. So as long as one of the two votes were reviewed, that would initiate a review, or if in case mediation doesn't work. And at that point, they inform the complainant and the accused that there's a review going on. And then once we recuse the people who obviously have conflicts of interest, then the Ops Committee would have two general body meetings worth of time to vote on actions or recommendations. So one possibility might be like a temporary suspension while they're reviewing. We think this is a pretty strong thing to do because of the whole innocent until proven guilty thing, so it would be used very rarely, and it would require a unanimous vote. And then that of course would be revoked if the person is found not guilty later. Another option is if they're in an internal or external committee, then since that public ed is directly approved by Ops, we feel that Ops should have the authority to revoke that appointment with a 2/3 vote. Another option is if it's an elected position, like say it's the chair of a committee or it's a delegate, then they can recommend removal, and then the voting members would then decide on something like that. So options like this would be like a division chief or an elected officer or a UA delegate or a voting member or a field rep. Basically things that Ops did not approve, things the body approved, or in the case of field rep, things that their field approved. So some notes just to kind of fill in some of the gaps here. Of course, confidentiality, a lot of these things is a big issue, so they need to be strictly enforced, and reasoning behind decisions needs to be archived, and the complainant's identity needs to be closely guarded as much as possible. And then it's also important that the people involved are informed before everyone else is involved, so that they get at least a day ahead of time. And then if there is a two-thirds vote to recommend removal, then the voting members would also have the two-thirds requirement to approve that recommendation for removal. And then, of course, field reps have the authority to, if they want to act further, on their own field members. And then also, if everyone on the committee feels that someone should be recused, they can vote to make that person recused. And it's important that both, and it's not just the complainant side of the statement of account, the accused has rights too, and they need to be heard as well during this process. And then, in certain cases where there's an immediate vote to be removed, we felt that there should be a right to appeal as long as there's reasonable doubts, which would be at least one person did not vote for it. And then we figured that the division chiefs are a separate body of experienced members of the assembly. That would be a logical place for an appeal to be brought to. And then they could, with a two-thirds majority, overrule that. So the next steps in this is, now that I've kind of outlined our ideas, is to get some feedback on what makes sense, what doesn't make sense. Hopefully add language about what happens if the university assembly wants to remove our appointee and we disagree, for example, because I know that was an issue. And then ideally we'll approve a draft of this in ops and bring it here so that we can update the bylaws of it. So any questions?
I have Nate first.
Yes.
All right. So there's a whole bunch of stuff in there. I have a question. I have a thing about it as a practical matter. I mean, maybe this isn't the perfect system I would advise, but it's got a lot of moving parts. Why did two-thirds votes kind of for so many things, first in unanimous, and then also, is it two-thirds of the members of office staffing, or is it two-thirds of the members of office staffing that show up to quorum? I know one of the biggest problems functionally with office staffing is that it is not just this year, but every year they're very historically and very hard to get together.
Yeah, so those numbers I literally just pulled out of nowhere just to put something on paper, I'll be perfectly honest.
Okay. So we can be tweaking those.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
I have two questions. The first one is, you mentioned that if things go to mediation, that the council would be the mediator. Why don't we get a professional mediator from the university, because they have those services available? It seems like a more appropriate thing to use. If the complaint goes to the council first, what happens if there's a situation where the council is, if not actually part of the complaint itself, actually directly connected in ways that refusal would be appropriate in that case.
All right, so those are two excellent questions. The first one being, what happens, can we get someone besides counsel potentially to mediate?
Someone externally professional.
Yes, that's of course an option. That was, it just made sense that if the person is already there, it depends on really how formal the process the complainant wants to go through, right? I mean, that is an option, right? That's something we can definitely take into consideration. And then, as well, there were ideas thrown out there for who should be a secondary person. I mean, VP Ops would be a logical person, although I really could easily be someone else in the assembly, or maybe even the Office of Assemblies, potentially, depending on how exactly people want to go about it.
So you talked about the importance of having confidentiality and also archiving. Archiving where?
So that was another point of contention, is whether it should be in the Office of Assemblies or not. I mean, I feel like that's the most logical place for it. But yeah, that's another thing that would add on to their docket or maintain it, right? So wherever it is, it needs to be accessible if a member needs to request access to it.
Thank you. very much for this. I know it's a lot of work, but at the optimism, we do a lot of this. I guess the question I have is, policy wrapping is very legalistic.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings up, okay, if you make it not from a legalistic point of view, then you're a walker in a FERPA.
Mm-hmm.
In theory, FERPA, you have the right to all educational material and disciplinary records regarding you. You're free to take a formal disciplinary process in the university. Then, in theory, your confidentiality will be bring up some file FERPA request in legally the university, and we're bound by it because it's a federal law. So I'm just curious in terms of how you want, and also the thing is, like, okay, what happens if I'm not in a formal process, you're going to walk into the code of conduct. What role does the judicial coach counselors play if someone wants to have a defense to help with their friend? And I think this is a good process, but the thing is, there's just a lot of, and I think it's still around, but I think there's a lot here that still needs to be really thought through in terms of, okay, if you're going to construct a legal process or a process that you can, and it's mirroring a legal process, you're going to be making a legal argument in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure this assembly is equipped to deal with someone who's really going to do that.
Right. So that's a fair point. I honestly don't have a good answer for this. I mean, ultimately, it's the assembly's prerogative if we want to make it just like a guideline of how to go through these things or a formal thing. What I do know is that in recent incidents, the fact that it wasn't a formal thing kind of bit us. So that's why I was kind of leaning towards that as kind of a reaction. But again, that brings up the point of, like, the more towards that you go, the more external ramifications there are, I suppose. And if there's, like, something that is involving, like, the JA, right? Because, like, obviously we don't need to be, like, ruling on whether a sexual assault occurred, for example, right? That's not our jurisdiction. Our jurisdiction is whether, should this person still be serving in our assembly in that position, right? So, I mean, those are different criteria. And I would imagine that if something like that was going through, like, the JA at the same time, and it's a strong possibility there might be, like, a separate conversation going on at the same time.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you, Alex, and others who's off the staffing for actually taking, I know that's a lot of work to do, we have a lot of work to do, but I appreciate you taking seriously the resolution to actually have these conversations. I think if a policy like this, all fleshed out, existed 6 months ago, our body would look very different, and I think that we're making progress. So I just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you, Manisha.
Yeah, so I wanted to touch on some of the things, like, regarding professional mediators. I mean, I think that's definitely a possibility, but, like, having served on exec and, like, some of the things that come to exec, it's very often not something of the thing that I would ever really make it come. Like, this is actually something that I would only imagine happening, like, once, maybe twice a year max. It's very rare that this sort of thing actually happens, which is, I think, why we were so unprepared, I think, in terms of our governing document for it. I think that it would be great to get more feedback from, like law students if they wanted to help us out with it. I don't think that was some of the conversations, but I think most people in the room were not lawyers, and we're just trying to, like, think through a process, not necessarily, like, the specific language. So I think that would be really, really helpful. But it's still a draft, but I'd love to see it.
Awesome. So we're running really late, so if the rest of the people can keep their questions short. Aravin?
I'm wondering why the abuse process is limited and not across the spectrum of consensus.
So one of the rationales was, I don't know how you could appeal a recommendation when the voting members are going to vote on it anyway. So first it has to be something that the only things that ops can actually do are removal of internal or external appointments, right? So that's the only thing that'd be appealable logically anyway. And then it just also didn't make sense to, like, if the entire room agrees, I don't think that it needs to be appealable. So that was the rationale. But that can also be up for debate.
Okay, and last, Joe.
Are you going to enforce confidentiality when there is no enforcement mechanism of confidentiality currently at universities because of Mr. Bride?
That is something I don't have a good comment for right now. That's perfectly honest.
Well, just write Mr. Bride's name to the record. He's not here.
Oh, yeah.
No mechanism, but they're not here to talk about themselves. So just write your name to the record.
Sure.
Is that a second?
Yeah, that's a second, I guess.
Okay, any dissent to doing that? Okay, so none, please strike that. Okay.
All right. You can reach me with any questions or comments about this at AML372, and there will be another meeting probably this next week to keep discussing this.
Thank you, Alex. We're running behind on time, so let's keep the updates short. Manisha,
you're going to hate me. Motion to add during my update an election of a master's in engineering voting member. We have somebody who's actually interested in that position. I'd like to give them the opportunity to run for it.
Any dissent? Okay, seeing none, we will have that voting right now. Any nominations? Yes.
I'd like to nominate Samir. I'm going to say last name. Do you want to say it for me?
Okay. Can you say something about yourself very briefly? Just from there, yeah.
Okay. So a little bit about myself. I did my undergrad here, and I was, I guess in terms of like where my interest in GDSA comes from, I was on a really good student assembly committee because I was never actually a voting member of the student assembly, and I got a lot of experience in terms of, you know, trying to see how best I can make an impact on the community. And one of the challenges, one of the biggest challenges that I faced as an MS student is figuring out how to do that now that I only have 1 year left here and I'm basically about to leave. It's hard to, you know, make that commitment to any organization, especially when you're not, you know, there for the future. And so what my main goal is when, by wanting to join the GPSA is to make sure that in the future that MN representation is actually there. So there are a lot of issues that do face MN students. We're kind of very often that quick program that the school likes a lot, but we still pay tuition that is way more than undergrad tuition. And there are serious problems that happen in terms of like the international population, getting students who didn't go here for undergrads who care about the issues. And so I have certain changes that I would like to see. For instance, having semester-long terms where in the second semester, students who, you know, didn't go here for undergrad really by that time have their foot in the door and really can work on making an impact at that point. And first semester being almost for students who are here for that one semester I managed, who basically were here for undergrad and had experience at this point. So that's some of the main things that I would like to approach.
Okay, thank you. So any other nominations for the voting member in a Masters of Engineering? Okay, so seeing none, is there any dissent? Yes. Is there any dissent to electing Samir to become the next, the new voting member from the Masters of Engineering?
Point of order, any member of the assembly can object to this because all members of the assembly vote in voting members. For
Masters,
so anyone who's
not. Okay, any dissent? Okay, seeing none, Samir, congratulations.
I have no other updates.
Continuation of exact updates?
No other updates.
Okay. Misha, you did not want to do any of these.
Oh, shoot. we have to approve the GPSA meeting schedule for next year. This actually has to happen today because it has to get on the university calendar. So here they are. I don't know why they're spaced this way, but if anyone wants anything, and
at meetings in April and in May, we're looking for missing them.
It's 2 pages.
What's 2 pages? Okay, that's fine.
Scroll down.
Scroll down. Oh. Okay.
So if you go back up to the March meeting, I don't think we're going to be able to meet in 201.
Cool. I would say that's 2019.
That might be a problem for some.
Yeah. 2019. Okay. That's my fault. 2019.
Motion to accept the meetings so long as the type of records.
Okay. And in defense to accepting this schedule. Any dissent? Okay, seeing none. The schedule is approved for next year. Thank you.
Okay, now I have no updates.
And next, operations.
Look for the email for more discussion of the conduct policy in the next couple of days.
Communications.
No updates.
Appro-
appropriations.
We'll talk about
it. Okay. Finance, Beth is in a hospital. So her update is the FC's meeting on Thursday night to decide budgets submitted in March, and they will announce the deadline for applying for summer funding soon.
Is she okay?
Yes.
Okay.
Student advocacy.
Our only update is that you should come to our meeting next Monday at 2 o'clock. Follow us on Facebook if you want to know where, or just stay up in there.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah, so I hope that everybody heard this at the last meeting because I wasn't here and I have to play again, unfortunately. But the task force, the presidential task force on campus climate, is still, the survey is still open. So we've extended the survey, the campus-wide survey, by 1 week. So it is now closing this Friday. So if you have not filled in that survey yet, please do so. It is a little bit, it will take you a little bit of time, but the information is extremely valuable, and we will very much appreciate DISC is also holding two more events this semester, probably the last two for DISC this semester. One is a what we're now calling a community conversation. They used to be community lunches, but community conversation sounds a little bit better. And so, well, it'll be food. But it'll be held on the 18th, Wednesday, from 1:30 to 2:30. There will be lunch. I'm pretty sure that I booked 133 Emerson Hall for that. But I'll send out an announcement with definite details. But that's one of our ongoing, we do those about once a month. But the big one is on the 25th, from 12 to 1:30, we are hosting What's Your Story event with Dean Vijay Pendakor, the Dean of Students. That will be in the International Room of Willard Strait. And lunch will be provided for that as well. So the idea there, Dean Pendakor has wanted for a long time to get to know graduate students better. This is an opportunity for you to meet him, talk with him on a personal level. He'll tell you the story of how he got Cornell and his graduate experiences and that sort of stuff. And you'll be able to ask questions about what he does, what the offices that are open to students do, and how you can work with him or receive services from those offices. So that's a really great opportunity. I'll send out an announcement concluding that as well. And you all get invited. All right?
Thank you. Programming?
Hi, guys. Grad ball, May 5th, 7 to 11. We have an Invictus event, so if you would like it, an RSVP, that would make me really happy. Tickets will be $20. They're going on sale April 20th. It'll be open for 2 weeks. And there are 400 available, so. Thank you.
Faculty awards.
I had a question for you.
Oh, yes.
Is that the Museum?
No, it's the Museum of the Earth. There will be transportation. Oh, also, if anybody has ideas, I'm going to have 3 stops on Cornell campus for the transportation, and then we'll be on rotation. So if there are particular places you feel strongly about it stopping, that is useful for everyone. Email me, cjc365. Thanks.
So the deadline is tonight for today's nomination, and I've decided to extend the deadline by a week. I will send out an email tonight. Please do forward that email to your constituents. We need more people to nominate faculty. We have around 7 weeks, which is a bit not a lot. So I really count on the entire assembly and on the constituency to just get the door done. And now I'm also looking for someone to take my chair. My committee next year. But if anyone is interested in here, just talk to me again.
That goes for all chair positions.
Yes.
So, GC?
We don't have any updates, but a reminder to the assembly, we're going to have 1 week position available for elections, and you get to work with Becca, who's fun to work with. Remember that being a GPSA rep on the GC is an influential position where you have to say, you directly speak to the dean of the grad school, and you have a say in the code of legislation that influences in every aspect of our life, both in terms of faculty that teach you and in terms of what's required off of you as a graduate student, and in terms of new programs that the graduate school offers. So if you want to be heard in one of the higher echelons of the graduate school, that's an option you should look forward to. And I'm happy to talk to you about it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll have an update from the Consensual Relationship Task Force in the following week. Grad school.
Very quickly. Save the date, May 4th, 4 to 5 p.m. in the Big Red Barn. After, was it 6 weeks ago tonight, the meeting gave us the idea we're going to have a first annual recognition ceremony to thank GPSA members. I don't want to give away any surprises. There will be gifts for everyone. And I had, there's probably not time, but I had very few time tonight with me. So that will be happening in our next meeting. And the final draft will be up, I think, next Monday. Yeah, April 15th. April 16th. So look out for that. Ariana?
Where are the sign sheets? Are they still circulating?
They should be moving around. I don't know where they are. Somebody has them.
Please have it. Oh, they're over there. Okay. So it's recirculating. Any other comments? Announcements? Okay. We're running out of time, so let's move on to new business of the day. And we have first introduction to Resolution 13, calling for the accommodation of international GCAs at Maplewood Apartments. Since I'm a sponsor, Alex will be chairing this part of the meeting.
So, we love all the sponsors of the resolution to come down, so, or at least be accessible for questions. I guess, Arvin, if you really wanted to stay there, you can stay there, but
you can come back. So, this resolution is actually, sorry for the edits, we thought it would be easier than trying to, like, amend everything on the floor, but this resolution is actually the culmination of a conversation that started last October or November, and it was brought to my attention and even the AFEST's attention by Alex and Pete, who are GCAs at Hasbrook, and I just want to give them an opportunity to sort of set the stage and tell a little bit about what this resolution is about and why it's important.
So, hi everyone, I'm Mitesh Sagal, and we both are GCA at Hasbro. So GCAs are graduate community advisor, and what our role is, we organize some programs for the community, which we think will benefit the community. We create a sense of community inside Hasbro, and as you all know, Hasbro is a very diverse community. We have families with kids living there, we have singles, we have international students, and about 72% of international students live in Hasbro. So, and our indirect role is also to take care of the mental health, which we, of course, in radio effect. So one of the things that came to our attention last semester was when Sam from EDR is a company that is developing the Maplewood complex. So they came to Hasbrook, they wanted to know what activities GPAs do at Hasbrook and how they can implement those activities at Maplewood. So we're very excited to hear that our inputs are being taken, and Maplewood will also be something that it has been in the past, a very friendly community, and it would be similar to Hasbro. But one of the key things that we came to know about during that meeting was that because Maplewood is managed by a private company, so international students can't be part of the leadership position in Maplewood. So we voiced our concern, and at that meeting, I think we were told that it's not quite clear what's going to happen. So they will talk to EDR and Carhill, and then I think we met with the EDR again Are you this semester? In December. And that's where we voiced a concern again that international students are a key part of the on-campus housing, and if you don't have international leadership, international representation in the leadership, it's not going to be a very good community here. So, and I think from that, this resolution came. We contacted GTSA, and then they talked to Connor administration, and then they proposed some amendments that needs to be done. And here we are. So I think
you will
talk about that.
Yeah, I can talk about that a little bit more. Yeah. So, so the specific problem is that right now, international students can work on campus, and the Maplewood Park used to be on-campus housing. But now that we've entered into this P3 model, it's off-campus housing, and international students can no longer serve. It's against their visa status. They can't, EDR can't hire them. And so when we brought this problem to the attention of, I think, the grad school, we also brought it to the Dean of Students office, I think we were sort of hopeful at the time that there would be some sort of solution, that Cornell might employ them and give them wages in another way or something. And we'd had a couple meetings, and then at our last meeting, it pretty much came out, yeah, that's not going to happen. And as some of the whereas clauses sort of state, there were some comments that really concerned us about the unpaid labor that international students would do. And so this resolution is, one, sort of a call for them to try and find a solution, but two, if there truly is no solution, we don't want any of the other on-campus housing complexes to be turned into off-campus housing complexes under this model, because that would exclude international students from applying and serving in these positions.
All right. Is that the end of your introduction?
Unless any of the other sponsors have anything they want to say.
Oh, all right. So far I've met the speakers.
So, the point of it is questions or resolution or general comments?
Q&A.
Yeah, Q&A.
I know you'll live to the reader just a second.
Okay.
Does anyone have any questions? Yes.
So I really like this, by the way, making things together. It seems like this is going. Addressing, normalizing the status of these alternate jobs for graduate students across the grad population. And I wonder if anything we added which addresses the fact that these jobs are very different from normal graduate student jobs in that they are paid much worse for the same time that they're teaching.
Do you guys have
any
comments?
My comment to that is I agree with you. I agree with you, particularly in the Maplewood model, which is worse than have GCA and Albert would get paid. And this is also something that I brought up at the meeting with EDR and Cornell that we were at, where the new model that Maplewood as a company and as a private company is employing is an hourly wage model, where GCAs go in, they punch a card, and they have to serve a set number of hours programming events. There are two problems with this. One of it is the classic setting an attitude and setting a tone for that position. Right now, the tone for the position that Mateek and Hal and his children are in is that they're good neighbors, they're leaders in the community, and they do whatever they can do over and beyond stated requirements to ensure the well-being of graduate students and professional students in the community. But when you make that an hourly punch-in, punch-out job, people go in to do what they need to do at the minimum requirement, and then they walk out, which is what is to be expected of this. So that is one problem in the broad idea in which it's framed. And the second problem is that right now, GCAs get, in Maplewood, they used to get a two-bedroom apartment for themselves, in addition to extra perks. There was a small stipend, and I think there was a bus lab, access to the gym maybe. So it was a fairly reasonable package, something that invites the best candidates to apply to the GCA. Right now, if you clock all the hours that you are allowed to clock at the GCA, you will get a one-bedroom and a three-bedroom apartment shared with two other graduate students available to you, and that's it. So in many ways, this model is poorer for people that are employed at GCA. And I also want to highlight that Cornell talks about this as the gold standard for fair governance, which in many ways is, because a lot of the inputs that we provided are now part of the apartment.
However, I want to point out that this concern about GPA, both with regard to GPAs as a whole, how much they're being paid, and in terms of the concern for international GPAs, were raised very early on, even before the old method had been raised. And yet, it was something that we deal with when we get to it, and now we're dealing with it.
Yeah, I would also say we would be, I think, fully amenable to an amendment of that sort when we enter into discussion on the resolution.
Does anyone else have any questions for the sponsors? Yes?
I guess, they dealt with the administration and how much they like to add and speak, and since the party really should be opportunities for this. Didn't the administration provide any possible solutions to the situation?
So the solution, which is sort of highlighted in the resolution, was the idea that don't worry, we will train our domestic students to build that sense of community, which we were very unhappy with. Nathan Arvin tried to put forward an idea for, off-campus housing fellows that, just kind of floated and didn't really get a lot of response back from them. Either of you could talk about that. That was sort of we came into that room with this option and it didn't.
Well, it was sort of so it was said that there's no pot of money for that option. That was all we heard from that meeting. And
we did try to be we could talk long-term strategy, but it just didn't. It didn't, yeah. So, I don't know if Nate or Arvin.
There's two parts here. One is this is a problem that we can think creatively to solve it without not being too legally creative, which is a real concern. I recognize EER, although it's their decision to, set the kind of low, not salary, but the low pay for these new students, they are pretty strictly limited about who they can hire. They can't hire international students if they're applying for them like that. That's not something we can get around that easily. But I believe that there are some other ways that we can structure this if we were creative. The pushback, though, is not that this idea might not work necessarily, but in fact, there's no magic pool of money we have in it. The problem, in my mind, is that when we were this whole process is in place in the main board departments that currently existed, and we didn't. The expectations we went in are not that we're going to bulldoze on-campus housing or replace it with off-campus housing or off-campus housing. This is a replacement. This is not on-campus housing, financially. But it needs to serve all the functions that our on-campus housing currently serves, and the response factor is a little incongruent that we said, this is what you need to do to serve on-campus students, and they're saying, now this is off-campus housing, so we don't have money for any of this stuff. I don't mind that. All right.
Can I have a big one? So I think that there's this difference in assumption, right? We want this to be sort of comparable to Hasbrook, not quite like Hasbrook, but striving to be like Hasbrook, whereas, the Cornell administration sort of came from the viewpoint that, this is off campus and should not be, compared to Hasbrook. But, as we have also stated in one of the various clauses, this is advertised in the grad school announcement, and, so it is not off campus housing, right? So, and I think that, I don't know how we can sort of unify that, mismatch in expectations.
And to the admin point, even if this isn't going to change anything, we really want it on the record that we are against this and that we are against the transition of any other off campus for future assemblies that want to use this language to protest that.
All right, so in the interest of time, I think we need to move on to the next resolution. I'd like to thank the sponsors for presenting it, and it will be on the docket at our next meeting.
Okay, and next we have introduction to Resolution 14, updating the bylaw procedure, eligibility criteria, and obligations.
Oh. You want the up and down version? Okay, so our resolution is number 14, and it's about updating the byline procedures, eligibility criteria, and obligations for the how we set the activity fee. And Appendix A, which is should be in the packet that we all picked up, that is upside down, but that's not my problem. Appendix A is directed towards how GPSA and AC members actually set the byline allocations, and it gives us directions as to how to say motions and whatnot on the floor. As you can see in red are all the edits that we have been making in 2 5-hour meetings in the last 2 weeks. But we got it done. Okay. Some of the biggest changes in the Appendix A. First, it's called Appendix A and Appendix B to mirror the student assembly, how they do theirs, because a lot of these organizations apply for both the undergrad and the graduate student byline funding, so it's just to make it easier for them to understand. Also, in Appendix A, we added clauses about, I wrote this down. I think it's line 55 through 62 and 79 to 89 are about voting to eliminate funding for organizations. We didn't actually have words for that, and so that was one of the main changes we added. We also added those nice illustrative flowcharts, so it's easier to understand. And we added a more detailed timeline because it was very limited, and we just added more specifics. So that was Appendix A. Then we have Appendix B, which is more for the organizations themselves, and most of the differences are we added for the contents the difference between the initial and final applications, which wasn't, I think it was just like the final application before, and so we added the initial. And then specifically for item 5, which talks about the obligations. Specifically, we have more general obligations, so these are for every single organization. We added words about how they could promote through different listservs and such, and if they can't get a hold of the listserv, then you can like email the dean of students, and hopefully they can get you to the listserv so that they're publicizing their events more, because we found that a lot of them don't publicize enough, and so a lot of us don't hear about what is going on. And then the biggest obligation part that we could talk about is the Cornell Cinema, which starts at line 293. When we set the activity fee for this cycle, we set Cornell Cinema at $11 with the agreement that we would set in place something where we wean Cornell Cinema off the funding cycle. And so we have come to agreement with Mary at Cornell Cinema for these decreases of $2 over the next 4 cycles. So these are set so that each year they'll go down $2, but they don't have to do all the information and reapply. Like, they're going to be set for these 4 cycles. And then once it hits that last cycle in 10 years, who's ever here can deal with it the way they want to. And then at the end, we did add a lot of language about violations, because there was some sort of like mention of, if you don't do this, we'll do something against that, like fining you, but there was no actual set procedure for that, and so we did a lot with adding language. And the last page you should have in your packet, or it looks like the first page, is a chart at our AC members, there's 5 of us giving office hours this week. So please go through the old packets and the new packets, and if you have any questions, feel free to come to our office hours. There's 3 in person and 2 virtual. And
if you have any questions now, we are happy to hear.
Any questions? Nate.
Yeah. Thank you for all your recommendations to Marathon Special Students. My question is, in the GPSA obligations, line 41, number 4, there's no more than 20% GPSA budget if you are to travel like that, if you need voting members, exceptions maybe you should come through. I'm assuming that's referring to like the NAGPS and the IB Plus Summit stuff. Although, like, it's slightly more complex than that, because $500 is like what we spend on NAGPS is like fees, and most of what we spend when we like go somewhere, when we do go somewhere, is actually on lodging and not on travel, and so that's like the same deal. Also, we're hosting the IB Plus Summit this coming year, in which case you're not traveling anywhere, and so the IB Plus money might go with that, but does it go against this limit? It's kind of like a technical question on like travel versus is your attempt at like NAGPS, IB Plus Summit related activities. That's kind of just like stupid thought.
The executive producing that in this.
We can also talk about that during the
question.
No, that's a good question.
Okay.
How is the traveling set up last?
Yeah, so this is mostly an inherited thing that became an issue when we wanted to fund ASAP for their buses at the March for Science, and one person raises that's like, this is the reason why we have this in there, you shouldn't be doing this, and then the assembly ultimately didn't care, and we did anyway. But so what we were trying to do is sort of respect the idea behind that, which is like you don't want people that are in the political class of the GPSA to be benefiting. So it acknowledges that while at the same time saying like, but there's reasons when we can go around this. But you raised a great point. Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
And it could also be looked at too when we set the GPSA budget for next year for the GPSA.
Yeah.
Manisha?
I want to reiterate Dave's point, thanking AC for this, and I particularly want to thank the members of AC who worked with Cornell Cinema, not just this semester, they've been working with them since last summer. So, thank you to you folks. No, my question is not about Cornell Cinema. My question is about this survey in line 44 for GPSA. I raised this question when I came to the AC meeting, and I'm raising it again. Who exactly in the GPSA is responsible for this? Like, is it a committee? Is it us as a whole? Like, who is it exact? Who is responsible for? Yeah, the information. Who is actually responsible for making sure that that's right? 484.
I've heard 44.
I'm sorry that I don't have the information.
Okay, so.
Yeah. So I guess the certain point is actually an excellent point. That means that the obligations documents are generally on the more general side in terms of the organization, how they see it must do something. It's weird for us because we write our own rules, but generally that's going to be put in our bylaws or determined internally. It's nowhere else in the document do we say X group, subcommittee, or whatever must do it. I think we need to determine who does it. I'm not sure the obligations are the right place to put that because it would be not in keeping with how we handle everything else, but it should be noted in our bylaws or charter or somewhere else that if we're going to do this, it has to be under someone's permanent job yard.
And that was also our intention by explicitly writing all of the questions and what kind of answer they should receive by reducing much of the labor that's associated with that. And also most of the questions are very quick analysis, like Google Form or whatever service ends up being used, we'll do that automatically for the most part.
Okay.
You also build a built the sensor.
He built one, so.
You can use, you know, it's really easy.
More questions? Okay, seeing none, please visit their office hours if you have more questions, and we'll be voting on this next meeting. And we have one specific thing. If you have any questions specifically about Cornell Cinema, look for the time, the virtual time with Krista, because she works specifically with Cornell. So next we have the last item on our agenda for today, introduction to resolution 16, ensuring full representation for professional students in the GPSA.
Okay, so while we pull that up, I can just start by saying, so this semester I've sort of been taking over for the professional school division breakout, the division chief, and this is something that I noticed was really coming up a lot in the conversations we were having, that was very much like, we're not equally represented in this assembly, and so that's something that I've heard before, and we talk about it, but we never really do anything about it, and so Matt and I drafted, and then Gabriella also helped and Cheyenne, I'm trying to figure out, I know all of you guys want spring break, so I'm trying to figure out who everybody has helped out, but all sort of drafted this legislation, this resolution, so that we could make sure that the professional student in our, literally in our name, graduate professional student assembly, are actually represented on the floor.
And yeah, we'll answer.
Yeah, so we go into Q&A now. Any questions for the sponsors? Jesse?
Could you say, if you know, you were talking about specific numbers, and you got to B3 by 44 in terms of, you know, the research jobs in school district 3 for loss of
the professional. Yes, I can do that.
Yes, thank you.
So, it's actually, so you look at the university statistics, the way they break it down is the professional, the graduate professional school district, well, and when they do break it out, the professional schools, the three professional schools, Wabat, Jonathan, are about 33% of the total population. So looking at that, and also Law and Jonathan are roughly the same size. So that's why it was, in essence, if you're going to go up, this brings them to, in essence, the professional schools would be a third of the voting membership, and in line with their size, and they would also be kept in line. It also adds some delegations for the larger professional master's program, the three largest, which is MILR, M Engineering, and CBUM.
Can I talk about that? And I think sort of our intention, it wasn't in this language as well, was to make those seats easier for them to run for. So like, so our, for the professional schools, sort of do like internal elections, and that was something we like talked about but didn't formalize, but like could be a future formalization that makes it easier for master students to actually have someone filling that master's voting seat.
Yeah, so one of the concerns that I know has been raised is that with these seats, a lot of times, like, we struggle to fill some of these, like, master's seats, for example, it would be historically unfronting. So what things are we going to do in addition to this to encourage people to actually fill the seats that we are providing?
The biggest thing is, for the master's students specifically, by designating students directly on our charter, we can go to those master's programs and say, in essence, you can have an introduction similar to the way the professional schools currently do. But a lot of its assemblies, just no fault of its own, is really, really drag heavy. Even actually, the last thing, May 4 resolution, it has a small typo in it, but it used a number that is only for grad students and didn't include professional students. It's not malicious, it's just a typo. And that, in essence, the assembly is so heavily bent towards grad students that you're, in essence, until you start giving enough seats for professional students to be in the assembly, it's hard for myself, Gabrielle, Cheyenne, our last name, to really turn the ship when we're less than 15%. I mean, I'm not a voting member. So the idea here is to say, here are these seats for master's students specifically, go to those active programs so they can run into interrupts if they want to.
So, like, the seats will drive the interest, is what you're saying.
Yes.
I like that.
Why did you choose the master programs that you did in
So the two that we, there's always been a Master's of Engineering seat. Regarding the other ones, those were programs that had been involved in the past and specifically asked to have a seat allocated and were interested in doing internal elections to fill the seat. So that was sort of why we did that. We would also be open to maybe making more of them undesignated to allow other programs, but that was why we included them because they had expressed interest to us in having a seat.
Also, what information we could find was in the three
what I could find, those are the three of the largest professional masters. There are like four or five other smaller programs. Some of them are down, some of them are very small. So in essence, that's why there's still an at-large seat for anyone who's interested. But then it was the biggest ones, I mean, should have some more formalcy. It also helps us build up.
My question to you is in the larger philosophy of the resolution, which is to provide a voice to those to populations on campus that don't have a voice parallel with their constituents or the size of their constituents on campus. And my question comes in two parts. The first part is, what percentage of graduate students are men students that there is only one seat for men students? And so if we're thinking about restructuring the GPSA, I think there's definitely a need for that, but I think this is trying to selectively fix a problem for which there is a void in math and the sponsors of the resolution today. Which is great, kudos to you, you've done a good job representing your customers, but I think we should fix it holistically. The second thing, as an interim chair of DISC last year, I reached out to several constituent student groups that are predominantly underage minority students on campus. And one unanimous concern across the board was that they said they did not have a voice in the GPSA and they didn't feel like they were included in discussions in the GPSA. And therefore, my question to you is, who's to say that field-based membership or department-based membership is the right way to go? Maybe there's other ways and hybrid methods that are better representative. If you look around the assembly, today is perhaps the most diverse group we have, and that is appalling in terms of identities represented across the assembly. And so my question essentially is, great, you're here to represent professional students today and you're increasing their voting members. I'm happy to bring a memorandum with signatures from underrepresented minority students to the next assembly meeting asking for additional seats for them. So whether we can stop, how we can make a holistic change to the mentality.
So I've also been a part of those conversations with student org, and I'm like, you know that I'm a fan of that idea as well. But there's a larger conversation there about how we structure those identity seats and which student organizations get seats versus is there one for everybody? Do we give the largest org one? Like, there is a conversation that has to be had there, and I think I would be very willing. I think any of us would be very willing. Like, I've already talked to you about this before, so we'd be very willing to do that. It was just that there was a conversation about what that structure would look like there that was not necessarily applicable in this one here. It was more like a numbers, like a straight, like change in numbers type thing for these organizations. But like, I'm very open to us having that conversation about what those seats would look like and how we would do that. But in terms of like, let's do a holistic thing, we've been very ambitious about doing holistic things in the past, and like, we don't really ever fulfill that. And like, this is something that we can do right now that will increase the representation of those like professional students on this campus that make up, like Matt said, 33% of our constituent body.
Can I respond to that?
Yes.
I can say that I'm just hurt. I'm hurt because it seems like a quick fix for a voice that is loud today. I would encourage us to write the tail course of this effort here to make sure that the assembly as a whole is more representative. Because, sure, we'll fix this today and then think we'll always put away important changes that we need to make to provide voices to traditionally vulnerable groups and underrepresented groups. But we always push it away because the larger conversation is hard to get to that.
Okay, so I'm Samir, and then Jesse, and then we'll close the bigger place for today.
Kind of want to, because I was very involved in the restructuring process of the student assembly, or the restructuring process that never went anywhere. But all of Arvin's points are really fair, but one of the biggest challenges that, and why we can't really put into a resolution like this, for instance, is it's a really heavy undertaking to try to speak for all, for as many of the underrepresented minorities as possible. We spent the entire year trying to come up with viable solutions, which we came up with a few, but even then, we knew that we were lacking in how to actually do that representation. And it has been one of those things that it is really difficult to do identity-based representation that way. And that's why it has to be a much longer conversation than just something like this. But this resolution is really important, especially coming from me, the fact that I'm like finally here, is that master's students also just don't necessarily always know about the positions that are available to them just because they're too busy trying to learn about it.
Thank you.
Jesse?
So we can point out that there is a structural moment in the GPSA right now for having this conversation because the GPCI is up, and that is a super fundamental structural conversation about the next 10 years of our organization. So people who are going to be here in the coming years, not me, wants to see the body change in fundamental ways. The GPCI conversation is a structural opportunity that exists for you. You don't have to invest in the space is there. Get involved in that conversation, and it is right to be doing that kind of work.
Okay. So we are on, we've run out of time. Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
So any dissent to adjourn it now? Okay, seeing none, we're adjourned.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.